The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Because you have to at least demonstrate that there's a problem. We do have a problem in the United States. And then the question is, what are you doing about it? That puts you into tier one, two, tier, or tier three. And tier three means you're one of the bad boys, you know, and you aren't doing it. You've got a serious problem, and basically the government refuses to do anything about it. So they put out that report. So since they can't comment in the United States, the Department of Justice has its own program that deals with it, a sophisticated one, which they're starting to do in this training of law enforcement, keeping track of prosecutions and whatnot, and using the U.S. legal structure to deal with that. And they also put out two reports. There's the Attorney General has a report to Congress, and then basically another set, so there are usually two separate major reports that come out. That's basically the bulk of what this notebook is about, is their reports. The last one is just one of many organizations, since it got mentioned in the video called RUGMARK. And RUGMARK is an international organization that basically certifies that the rugs being made in India and Pakistan, mostly India, are not being made by slave children. And the reason that children are abducted is why? With fingers, right? So they can work the looms. That's what they call the looms. And the looms use a fair amount of slave labor. And RUGMARK goes around certifying and checking them. And it adds, they said, $2 to $5, but you'd be surprised, I didn't do a check here in Washington, but in Denver, out of the 15 or 20 big rug companies, and some of them very old, 100-year-old companies, you know, sophisticated or wealthy companies, only six or so rug companies in Denver carry the RUGMARK. We did a little sting operation on some of them. Setting up, some of my graduate students got all dressed the nines like you guys are today, borrowed somebody's Mercedes and went and presented themselves, went to buy six figures worth of Persian rugs, and were, you know, sort of got the salesperson salivating in the process. And at the very end, she started lifting, it was all filled, lifting up the edges of the carpet saying, "Come, where's the RUGMARK?" And at first they basically claimed innocence and had never heard of the RUGMARK. What was she talking about? Except they gave themselves away almost immediately, because they then said in the same breath, "But we can guarantee that they're not. We don't use slave children." So they knew exactly what it was. So for the cost of adding $5 to a $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 rug, people are still not willing to engage in that process. So if you went to, if you know somebody's interested in buying a Persian rug or Indian-made rug, you went to the RUGMARK Foundation, for instance. And they do raids as well. So that's the controversial part of what they do. They do raids. In cooperation with law enforcement. And then they get the help with the kids, get them into another program to rehabilitate them. So those are the major organizations. Now let me go through some facts a little bit first. There's a lot more information up here than we're going to be able to deal with this morning. But I always like to have more, you know. The illness of being a professor, especially a law professor, is that you have to feel like you have to overwhelm your students on a regular basis, right? More information than they could possibly handle in any given time. So, 23 to 27 million slaves worldwide. That's a good estimate these days. Between 600 to 800,000 people are trafficked across borders each year internationally. 80% of the victims are women, and up to 50% of them are children. Trafficking generates between $7 to $10 billion annually, and that is going up. And I actually think the $7 to $10 billion is more in the sex slave trade, specifically. It doesn't even include domestic agricultural and produce, you know, production stuff that we have all in the United States. There are between 14. Now the film said the CIA said 50,000. I think that's a mistake. There's probably closer to 14 to 17,000, though. People trafficked into the United States into forced labor each year. How I got into this is when I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Washington, D.C. And because of the kind of strange jurisdiction, as some of you know, with the Attorney's Office here, is that you have both local and federal jurisdiction, the local DA, federal jurisdiction, but also because it's Washington, strange things happen, like when you pick up a trawler coming in from Central South America, it comes under the jurisdiction of Washington, D.C., District of Columbia jurisdiction. So I first got involved a number of years ago as we would pick up these ships, four or five ships, rusting hulks that would be coming
loaded with people with a mothership that would be monitoring the process. So the snakehead's monitoring all the people on board, and we would raid the places. And the first thing that I realized is just how nasty these people were, the traffickers. Now, I was dealing with major drug lords. That was my job. People trafficking in guns, but mostly drug lords. These are not necessarily nice guys, but there was a sense of, I don't know how you call it, even fair play. It was a game, all right? My job was to try to catch you, and your job was try to not get caught and then try to wriggle out of it as best you could, but we could actually sit across the table. And I'm not talking about nice people necessarily. You know, these are people dealing with death, as far as I can, dealing death and ordering execution of people from time to time. So not kind folks. But in comparison to people who traffic in other human beings, they were nice. There's a certain intense pathology about people who are willing to traffic in other human beings and treat them as product. And because it's just a product, they're willing to just get rid of them when they become inconvenient. So one of the things that we discovered right away was that these old rusting trawlers had charges set in the hull, so that the first time that the Coast Guard was on their way to board, they would set off the charges and sink the boats with everyone on board, killing everyone on board, right? Rather than have them be caught and possibly testify. They wouldn't think twice about it. So it was a very delicate operation to actually get on board, to defuse the charge and be able to do all of that, usually at night when the mothership couldn't exactly see what was going on. It was a SWAT team that would, Coast Guard sort of SWAT team that would arrive, because there would be people on board whose job was to set off the charge and then escape off the side. The other thing they found out was this interesting array that makes it even much more complicated, of people who had paid up front, in other words, were being smuggled, and if we have a chance we'll talk about different trafficking and smuggling. So they had paid their money, $1,000 to $5,000, they had the cash that they had paid. So they were free and clear when they got to the United States to do whatever they want. There were those who had promised to pay or paid part of $25,000 to $30,000, let's say, as the next group. And of course, the full range in between. These are people who will never be able to pay off their debt, because the interest rate on it is so high that it'll be impossible unless, you know, they somehow land an executive position, right, after they get to the United States, to pay off the trafficker. So they now get into a process of debt bondage, right, so that they are never free from debt. Then there's another group who basically were told, you can pay us after you get there. We have a good job for you, right? And of course, the good job does not exist. And the women go into the sex slave trade, commercial sex trade, or they go into the sweatshops in New York and other kinds of places. Now, the old sweatshops, as you might remember, were places that were pretty horrible places to work, minimum wage, unsafe conditions, and we put an end to it because for those two purposes, right? There's the famous cases of sweatshops burning down and women being trapped. But there was still the ability to actually make some money to take care of your family and get out of that situation so the next generation, right, would be able to be okay. The new sweatshops are basically somewhat like the brothels or the spas in the United States, is that the women are kept on one floor and guarded, and they work on another floor, and they never can leave and are not paid and all their documents are taken. Okay? Which is exactly how the brothels work, and we're going to talk about one form of the brothels right here in the Latino residential brothels that are here in Washington, D.C. as one aspect of it. So one of the things that you can notice about the brothels, for instance, the larger brothels, is that, and it should be a clue, is that, you know, like in Denver we busted one, and there were 70 Korean women, right? And they all lived upstairs and had bars on their windows. And I have to tell you, it wasn't keep the Johns out, right? And that was a clue, except the police didn't understand this. And it's not their fault. They need to be trained. I think of modern slavery and issues of modern slavery, especially on the domestic issues, sort of like domestic violence was 30, 35 years ago. Cops would show up to a house. They wouldn't know what to do, what questions to ask, what to look for. It wasn't even necessarily even against the law. There was no place to check on their form, so nothing could be done, and there were no social services that went with it. We're in the same kind of situation. So a cop goes, a vice cop goes, busts one of these brothels. You would think that there might be some indicator where there's 70 Korean women and they're all locked up upstairs, but that's not how he's been trained to think. What he sees is prostitutes and therefore criminals, And so they are treated as criminals. And that's been part of the real education problem, is that most people who are picked up by law enforcement who are actually victims are treated as though they're criminals, because they're either prostitutes or they're here illegally. So there's a labor, there's either a labor violation or visa violation, immigration violation, some kind of violation. And so they wind up in jail and not the trafficker. Or if the girls get picked up, one of your colleagues or one of your future colleagues will race down and get all the women out. And what they women don't know is that the tab for the lawyer's fee to get them out has just been added to their bill. All right? So adding more to the debt that they have. So right now we have the large concentration of forced labor, not surprisingly, is 31% in Texas, Florida 19%, and California 14%. Now, in forced labor in the United States, sex slave trade makes up 46%, domestic services 27%, agriculture 10%, sweatshop factory 5%, and hotel workers 4%. Okay. These are people not being paid. Understand, when we talk about slavery here, we're talking about old-fashioned slavery. In the sense that, yes, you might want to distinguish between what is old-fashioned chattel slavery, except in Mauritania, there's no place in the world where it's legal to actually own another human being, right? So chattel slavery, like that kind of slavery, again, all right, say that doesn't exist. So we have now contract slavery or debt bond slavery, right? So it's just forced labor, either up front that you don't get paid, or in some circumstances you are sort of turn of the century, what we call company towns. You worked for in the lumber industry in the Northwest in the 1800s. You went to work for the company, and the company owned everything. They owned your housing, they owned the bank, they owned the mercantile shop where you bought your groceries and clothing and everything else. And you never made enough money. You always got more and more into debt. Because if you got paid $200, it cost you $300 to live that month, as an example. That still goes on now in Colorado and Wyoming, for instance, with Peruvian shepherds. So in fact, the general consuls of Peru, Guatemala, and Mexico have gotten together and are now doing workshops on a regular basis with their constituency around Denver, and I'm starting to work with them. And the Peruvian consul general is going up in the mountains to talk to these Peruvian shepherds. They sort of bump the traditional Basque shepherds out, and only discover that they're not being paid. Or if they're being paid, again, you have to ask the right questions. So they say, if you ask simply the question, are you being paid? And the answer was, yes, I get paid $200 a month. You have to ask further questions, because you discover that the rancher is charging them $100 to live, $50 for clothing, $25 for medical supplies, another $50 for, you know, transportation. If you've done your math real quick in your head, right, we've already gone to over $200, right? So in fact, they're not making any money and are being told, in fact, that they are now in debt. And the curious aspect, almost universal, is these are honorable people who, even though they know they have been forced into debt illegally, feel honor-bound to pay it off. And in many countries, this slavery is not just attached to you as an individual, it's attached to your family and moves on from generation to generation to generation. You can buy somebody out of slavery and the whole family out of slavery for, you know, $20 in India that have been enslaved for three or four generations. And they owe what? $20, the equivalent of $20. It happened in Brazil all the time. You would say, tell people the guys who were being enslaved would know that they'd been cheated, and yet they felt honor-bound to somehow pay back a debt that they, on the other hand, logically could figure out that was an impossible debt to pay. So we have now investigations that have covered at least 90 different cities in the United States. This is a serious problem in the United States, and we begin to realize that it's a serious problem in the United States. So whether it's in Denver or Washington, D.C., and I'm going to talk about, again, the residential brothels, the Latino residential brothels here in D.C., I used to live here, so it wouldn't be very difficult to do. In an hour's time, I could find, here in D.C., I could certainly find you a residential brothel or a spa, as they're sometimes referred to, where the sex slave trade is taking place. I could find you domestic slaves pretty easily. And how does that work? Well, you saw the two domestic slaves in the film. They're from Africa, but they come from Central and South America all the time. And in Denver and here, it's easy to find. We could take a walk, and within an hour and a half, I'll guarantee I can find you a domestic slave. Right? And how does that work? Well, someone from, whether it's Africa, and, you know, it first started because people, foreign diplomats could bring in servants, and we never checked what kind of servants. Right? So there was this sort of gap in the process. But now what we see is that people who are doing well, so this nice, you know, middle class, upper middle class, Honduran family. You'll have to excuse me if somebody here is Honduran, because this is what happened recently in Denver. Basically is doing well for themselves and living comfortably in Denver and needs some help. I need some help. I need an au pair. I've got three little boys that could use this. So send home for somebody in their village, or somebody, you know, a niece, or just somebody from the village, a girl between 12 and 14 years old, and they tell the family, well, bring her to the United States and promise her all the things that, what, America's famous for. She's going to get a good education, she'll be clothed well and fed well and have all the benefits of being an American citizen. She gets here, her documents are taken, and she's basically put into forced servitude. And it's a fascinating pattern, but what the girl said is commonplace. Go to bed at 2:30 in the morning, getting up at 6, so you're exhausted all the time, so your defenses are down, you're beaten regularly, your documents are taken, you are told time and time again if you try to escape, either you'll be killed, which may not be true, although in the sex slave trade it is, right, without a doubt. That you're going to be picked up by the law enforcement and you'll be just sent home. And that is true. So the fears are all, you know, that are manifest. And people often wonder why these girls and women don't leave on their own accord. Well, then nobody's been paying attention to the problem of domestic violence then, and what happens with American women and girls who have the proper language, can, you know, have the proper documentation, and still are fearful of leaving the home, right? So if you can imagine, only worse, you're in a foreign culture and you're being told what exactly will happen to you. In terms of agriculture, that's where Kevin Bales was talking about it happens the most, at the lower end. And I've been trying to work on legislation to prevent slave-made goods coming to the United States. And of course, business is not happy with the idea. Because Nike or whoever it might be, I use them because they're sometimes iffy in their practices, would say, we don't employ slaves in our factories. Okay. Now, I want to distinguish here between what this term of art called slave wages, right, which are bad wages. What in Colorado, at least, I don't remember what it is here in the district, but it's $5.20 an hour. But the livable wage we know is $12.10 an hour in Denver. And so, as we know, there's this huge gap between minimum wage and what's called a livable wage. And that illegal workers in the United States are being paid less than $5 an hour, sometimes $2 an hour. We call that slave wages. But there is a certain kind of financial coercion, but these are men who can show up or not show up in the morning to be picked up on the corner to go do their daily labor, right? So there's a certain... don't confuse that with people who are not being paid at all, or being paid in such a way that, in fact, they are constantly in debt. That's a very different process. So what we have is at the lower end. So it may be true... So when you go to Walmart or those kinds of places and get a t-shirt or a dress shirt or a blouse or a pair of slacks cheap, there's a reason for that. And it's not just because they're good business people who are manufacturing at such great rate in a foreign place that they can keep the prices down. The problem, one of the dark sides, and I'm not an opponent of globalization, but one of the dark sides of globalization and forever, you know, moving out labor into cheaper and cheaper places, right, is that eventually you get to the cheapest place at all, which is you don't have to pay anything. And so while it may be true that the people making their T-shirt, the factory in China or someplace else is making your T-shirt, is not involved in slave labor, how about the person who picked the cotton? How about the person who made the bricks to build the factory? How about the person who made the charcoal that was used to make the steel to build the machines? That's where slavery is taking place, at least on an agricultural end. So at the very lowest end of the scale, if you wish. And businesses, and I can understand their trepidation, they don't want to say, we're not responsible. We're only responsible from our plant on. And of course, trying to convince them that, no, you're responsible actually from source on. almost like to tell them to take the McDonald's example, what they did in Russia. Some of you might be familiar with what they did in Russia. And when they got to Russia, McDonald's found out that the beef was so bad and the potatoes were all rotten and nothing worked, so they actually went out and bought farms and ranches and raised their own potatoes and raised their own beef that they then supplied to McDonald's in Russia. Right? This is a top-down. This is what's the terminology? Does anybody remember? Horizontal? Vertical. Coors Beer is one of those kinds of places that, you know, and a lot of companies, some chocolate companies and Nestle's coffee and chocolate, for instance, own from the plantations in terms of their coffee in Brazil all the way through to the end product, everything in between. So they're not amenable to free trade arguments because they basically say, we're not violators and we have complete control, so don't tell us that we don't treat our people fairly. And if actually they do a good job, I can't argue with that. And so if they have a complete vertical process, but I'm trying to suggest to companies that even if you don't have the complete vertical economic structure, that you're still responsible for making sure where the stuff comes from. And as Kevin said in the film, I'm sorry, he didn't say exactly there, but in the bigger film, 90% of the West African cocoa, which is the largest place in the area where cocoa is made, is used as slaves. So there's no doubt that if you eat chocolate, you are participating in the slave trade. Now, but as he said, the problem is that the knee-jerk reaction that we would have is what? Boycott chocolate, which makes the problem worse. That's what makes it a very complex problem. So you have a complex economic problem. You have also a complex, if you want to say, moral problem. Because, quote, women who willingly, and I put that in quotes, willingly enter into prostitution. Now, to tell you, a woman who lives in Albania who is single and has three kids and is starving and is given the opportunity, even if she knows exactly what it means, that she's going to be a prostitute in Rome, right? She's going to make money and send it home, okay? When she gets to Rome, all of a sudden she discovers that none of that is true. Yes, she's not going to be a prostitute, she's going to be a sex slave, and she's going to be bought and sold between organized crime. In fact, when she's done, she's used up there, maybe she'll be put on a plane and sent to Japan and be sold to the Yakuza. So organized crime is actually really organized amongst themselves. So they buy and sell people, especially women in the sex slave trade, to move them around and whatnot. And you can imagine an Albanian woman who now discovers herself in Tokyo under literally the gun of the Yakuza, right? So I also want to be careful to be clear about the difference between, quote, willing, and I don't know what willing means anymore because I've seen too much of the process of that. That's a gray area also. The number of women who truly are, you know, freely go into prostitution versus those who have to because of economic situations. Okay, I think there's a difference there. But there's a sharp line when it moves from lack of, in other words, she doesn't see any of the money, and she has no freedom of movement, and violence is used to coerce her into this trade. I think it really gets cut off there. We can have all sorts of discussions about the morality or the lack of morality of prostitution, but and there may be a big difference, clearly a big difference between the Bunny Ranch in Nevada, as an example, a residential brothel here in Washington, D.C., right? But I think it's clear that you can put a bright line. You can say, you're not getting paid, you're beaten into submission, right? There's no sense of freedom, and when you're used up, you're spit out, right? And no money is going home, quite frankly, at that point. Not even a possibility of it. Okay. So what do we have in the United States? We have the 13th Amendment. I hope everybody remembers what the 13th Amendment is about, right? Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. So, no involuntary servitude except those who are prisoners, right? Convicted legally. So you can have involuntary. So that was actually, by the way, an interesting caveat, a little loophole that was used for a long time by prison officials in the United States doing what we told the Chinese that they shouldn't do, which is to use prisoners as free labor, right? Which is a common practice in the South and in Texas and lots of other kinds of places. And we jump all over China for doing the same thing, but we've been doing it and continue to do it. It's not, it's no longer legal statutorily, but the loophole still exists constitutionally, if you want to put it that way. Okay, so we have that. Then we have 18 U.S. Code 1584 and 1581, and that deals with involuntary servitude and peonage. And I won't go into the details of that, but that's the, that was what was, you had the 13th Amendment and you had this, these two things. And basically, 1584 makes it unlawful to hold a person in condition of slavery, which is compulsory service or labor against his or her will. And it was requires that the victim be held by actual force, or threats of legal coercion. Well, any of those three words. Okay. And you can't create a climate of fear. In other words, you can't say, I'm holding you, and but if you try to leave, I'll contact immigration. Okay, so it's a violation even under that. Peonage, which is 1581, basically is debt bondage. In other words, you can't force someone to work because they owe you something. Right? Remember the debtors, old debtors' prisons kind of sensibilities? So that's, we even have enshrined, we call it debt bond slavery now, but it's the old form is called peonage that we statutorily have is illegal in the United States. But then we came to the, fairly recently, to the TVPA, Victims of Trafficking and Violence Protection Act of 2000, the TVPA, and then the Reauthorization Act. So let me do the what the TVPA does. There's a Bradley Miles, who's the national director of Polaris Project, gave me this wonderful way to think about what that act is, and that's the what we use the most now in combination with 1581 and 1584. AMP, action, means, and purpose. So the action is, are you recruiting, enticing, harboring, transporting, obtaining, subjecting someone to this, or inducing them to do it in some fashion? So it takes an action on the part of the trafficker, right? There's a means. The means, class ones, are force, fraud, or coercion, any of those. Now, the caveat on this one, means does not apply to minors. So so you don't have to use any of that. If you have a minor in the sex slave trade, for instance, or forced labor of any kind, this does not, you don't have to find this part of the law to use it. Third part, the purpose, class of commercial sex act, or forced labor, which includes basically everything. And there's nothing outside of that. In addition, 1584 requires bodily harm. There's a lesser standard in the TVPA, serious harm. So harm has to have been done. Again, not here. Harm is presumed if they're minor. So you don't have to worry about that. Okay. So this is, the serious harm is an inexact, as you might imagine by looking at it, is an inexact standard. Because it doesn't require any more. What's nice about it, what is clear, because if you think it's something different from bodily harm, which is good to know, it means that it's not just bodily harm. It means mental or even spiritual or some kind of psychological harm is done, and that would be considered serious harm. Unlike Gonzalez's memo on torture, you have to have it's a lesser standard, if you wish, that you had hoped to gain. In other words, you'd have to be close to dead or insane, right, under his standard of torture. Right? So this is what needs to happen with the TVPA, to use the TVPA. That's what's used most, this with the old statute here. Now, one of the things that I put a myth buster down here is that trafficking does not have to cross a border. Most people think that that's what trafficking is. You can have internal trafficking. And in fact, what we're discovering here is something even darker underbelly, which is a little bit nerve-wracking for many of us, is that the presumption is that the sex slave trade and the trade to women and children is cross-border stuff, right? Coming in from Central South America, across the Mexican border, through the Caribbean, you know, the ports, whatnot. But what we're discovering is that there's trafficking going on in the United States amongst U.S. citizens, U.S. citizen children. And what we're discovering is the high number of runaways, foster children, homeless children who have been trafficked in the sex slave trade. And that's only because we're just now starting to ask those kinds of questions of these kids. Never been asked before. So again, you know, don't ask a question, you don't know the information. So there's another organization that you put down here called Free a Child, which is in Boulder, Colorado. And they started off in Thailand, because that was a problem in Thailand, only to discover that they had just as serious a problem potentially here in the United States. And quite frankly, this is making a lot of people very nervous. Because it's one thing to deal with all those foreigners, right, coming into the United States. And you can be sympathetic, and it's a problem we have. But it's sort of churning the stomach of certain, you know, people, and I'm not sure how they're going to react to it, because you could have a good reaction to do something about it. You could also have, sort of a rejection, because it's so horrific to think, of a fairly large population of kids, children, U.S. citizen children, who are being trafficked within the United States. We first started discovering this with young women being moved from place to place. And that's how a lot of these places work. In other words, they set up a brothel and they basically rotate women and girls like every 2 to 3 weeks. Classic kind of process is that law enforcement didn't pay attention to the foreign brothels, but when they discovered the nice Anglo brothels, that raised concern. You know, we wouldn't want to transport nice Anglo Midwestern girls around. So that's actually how the first investigations came around, to discover that these were U.S. citizens who were being trafficked around the United States. Okay. So, and there is a difference between these two, between trafficking and smuggling. I just put it up the laundry list. Okay. And you can read it for yourself. But there's clearly a distinction. Not the least, smuggling is something that someone is willing to do, wants to do. Now, I've got a bunch of scenarios which we don't have time to go through, but smuggling can easily turn into trafficking. So, you know up front that you want to enter the United States and you're going to do it illegally and you're going to pay out some money, right? But when you get here, the situation changes. Or you sign a you are told that you're going to come to the United States even legally. You know, there's a visa process to come to the United States legally, and you're told you're going to be paid $10 an hour. When you get here, you're only paid $3 an hour. Right? That's not even smuggling, because it was legal, but it's become trafficking, because now that's coercion. People do not live on $3 an hour. Right? That's what we know. Okay. So there is a difference, and the mistake that's made here is in law enforcement is they presume that people have smuggled. In other words, it's all willing. They're all doing it because they want to be here, right? And you can even want to be here and even arrange to get here. Selling of brides from Russia, for instance, why not? I've heard the discussions that the girls have in Moscow apartments. I'm going to take advantage of this. I'm going to get in that case, marry this old geezer, and the myth is that I can divorce him in 90 days and be able to sit. You know, immigration actually doesn't work that way. But so her intent is not exactly pure, right? She's going to figure out how to get here and then take advantage of the system to be able to stay. Except the problem is that when she gets here, she's actually been brought in by the Russian mob, and she's brought to a Russian club, and then she's bought and sold, right, as a quote bride. But she becomes the bride through a succession of men over a period of years. Yeah.
How do you respond to the argument?
Well, I guess what was one of my conditions was what? That they not be paid. And that's what the gray area is, because with the time remaining, let me go through a complex scenario, which is here in Washington. Not just here in Washington. This is just this section. This list deals with the Latino residential brothels. Now, I wish it just deals with commercial sex acts here, but obviously there's a problem dealing especially with agriculture and domestic. Men and women are going from Latin American countries, are going into both of those areas as forced labor. Now, what happens here, it's not just Latino residential brothels, these are all specific. So you can find a Korean version of this, or the Russian version of this, and so they are very specific. And the way it works is that there are either open or closed systems. And how this works is an open system means that this brothel is open to any man, right, who has the money and has the contacts and knows how to get it. Now, none of these are illegal in the sense that they're not hiding under the guise of being a massage parlor, for instance, right? They're clearly illegal. Closed systems, and that's the more arising version of this, is that it's closed to only that ethnic group that can prove themselves to be from that ethnic group. And so they have, it's a very tied into a very tight community, right? And it's by word of mouth. And the brothels tend to be, the residential brothels tend to be very small, 2 to 4 women who are being rotated out every few weeks, right? And they're, and so, and it's the men, for instance, are basically a lot of day laborers, on the lower economic scale. Now what happens with between prostitution and sex slave trade is what? One costs less than the other, right? So that it's servicing a lower end of the economic scale. And the way you find out is by word of mouth, by card, by certain kinds of things. You can read it in Washington, you can find it in the weekly papers, right? If you know what to look for, right? Where they are, and not so hard to find. So, and the men are pretty carefully vetted, you know, to make sure, and there's a lot of law and enforcement. The women are forced, they get chips or the leftover condoms as their receipts, the packages, they are all in debt bondage, basically, in one form or another. They're having to turn 15 to 30 tricks a day. Now, there's a range between women supposedly voluntarily being there, which is hard for me to imagine, to those who are clearly under slavery. The average income is about $2,500 a week. That money is going to the John, not to the girl. Right. So we're talking about conditions that are pretty hygienically awful. Health care is clearly non-existent. The use of condoms is completely unnecessary. These are 15-minute trips, basically. $30, 15 minutes, right? Kind of process. So what I have here is an investigative report for Washington, D.C. I won't go into the details of it, but to tell you, if you give you an idea, in D.C. there are this is for Latino residential brothels. There are 5 open networks, 7 closed networks. Maryland, 4 open network, 8 closed network. These are the ones that we've been able to find, right? In Virginia, 2 open and 8 closed. So in the greater D.C. area, there are 34 Latino residential brothels that we know of operating right now. Okay. So what do you do about this process? Well, you get involved with your community, right? You start having to educate. And some of the best practices, and unfortunately we're not going to be able to get into the tiering process of which countries are in what tier, if you're interested in a specific country, I'll be happy to tell you afterwards, is that countries are starting to basically let folks know. So in Russia and Brazil, for instance, you know, though Brazil has some problems, they're doing some really positive things, which is to say any woman or girl who gets a visa to come to the United States, basically they're giving them information saying, like in Russia, they hand them a flyer that says, working abroad can be a wonderful thing, but it could also mean this. And they're starting to keep lists of companies in the United States who are not truly what they say they are, all those kinds of things. And giving them basically worldwide 800 numbers to say, and the Russian girls, and a girl who's been brought to the United States from Russia and is in the sex slave trade here, if she can get this phone number, which gets her to Moscow, right, within 2 hours, the FBI is where she is. Right, so we're starting to have this international cooperative process. But it also means that the individual communities need to be educated. There's education that happens with law enforcement, legislatures have to be educated, but the people themselves have to be really educated. Right? And to be able to be willing to speak up when they see these kinds of things happening. Because that's what happens, as we all know, in closed communities, is that you don't want to engage out the outside, right? Especially law enforcement. You don't want, the fear, of course, is immigration coming into your neighborhood and finding all sorts of other kinds of things. And so people turn a blind eye to slavery that's happening in their own community. And I think that's why, at least in Denver, the Guatemalan, the Peruvian, and the Mexican Consul General is discovering that they're having to educate their constituents within Denver and Colorado to start really paying attention to this process. You need to get involved also, right? So there is a Free Slaves, there is Polaris Project. You can set up something like I've done in DU. I have the only sort of up and running graduate program so that people can actually study modern slavery and human trafficking. And it's at its infancy, but it's an interdisciplinary approach. So it not includes all the disciplines that you find in international studies, law school students from Stern College of Law, business school students from the Daniels College of Business, and graduate school social work, international trauma psychology, folks who deal with institutionalized or genocidal rape and torture, folks from international intercultural communication. Because you have to have, I think, a multidisciplinary approach to this problem to look at it to bring some resolution to it. But there's nothing more important than you becoming aware and then passing on that information to your friends and colleagues, right? And letting your communities know that this is a serious problem. And right now, still to this day, what we're discovering working a series of programs with Univision is that many communities basically refuse to acknowledge it as a problem. Right? One, because it shows a dark underbelly to the culture. Right? Now, the problem is, and I don't know if this is helpful, but everybody's doing it, so it's no specific culture who's engaged in this process. So it's not a shame on any particular culture. All cultures are involved in this process. The problem is that it's rising at a phenomenal rate. And even President Bush named it 6 months ago as after terrorism, drugs, and guns, trafficking is the fourth most serious problem for national security. That's why he's got, if you notice, it's interesting to note, it's a national security directive he put out, not an executive order. It's a national security, it's that important that it involves the concept of national security in dealing with trafficking. And I know Kevin likes to think that it would be wiped out somehow. I don't have those kinds of hopes, I have a hope, but he's more idealistic than I am. Except that I think that what we can do and where the places that we live, in every state that we live in, and every community that we live in, is basically get the word out to the community, but also to let the traffickers know that your community or your state is not a traffic-friendly state. Do I think it's a huge problem in Colorado? No. But I don't want it to become a huge problem. So I'm going to make it clear through all sorts of different processes, including legislative acts to say, you come here, we know what to look for, and we're going to put a halt to it. So go someplace else, right? And it would be nice if we got to the point where there was no place to go. This is, much like in drugs, this is a culture that is a destination, right? When I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office, remember when we gave $1 billion to Colombia? We all laughed at that. We thought that was one of the bigger jokes, right? That wasn't going to do anything. Because why? Because we're the consumers. As long as you have consumers, you're going to know this process of demand, right? And so we're a consumer country. We're also a producing country in terms of trafficking, but mostly a consumer country. So we obviously want people that we can enslave here, whether it's a sex slave trade or in agriculture or in manufacturing or hotel work or domestic. And we just have to make it clear that that's not acceptable human behavior. Human beings do not keep other human beings as slaves, period. So I'll leave it with that, and I know we've run late, started late, so we're running late. And I'll stay here and happy to take questions. Again, feel free to take my card. And got any questions on the topic matter? We didn't get, we sort of touched on a little bit of everything, didn't we? To some degree. So I usually need about, 3 hours to get things started. So, questions? Feel free to, don't feel like you're stuck here, but I'll take questions. Okay. That's an intense debate right within the United States, right, all the way up to the state department. John Miller is an anti-prostitution person, for instance, the ambassador, and that's the stance of this administration. There are others who basically would take the argument saying, if you legalize prostitution, if you take sort of the stance of the bad and have it that one. Now, so there's a difference between when you talk about legalizing prostitution, are you talking about just making prostitution legal on the streets, or are you willing to regulate it like they do in Nevada? There's even an argument there. Because I have to admit that most of my adult life, I simply thought of prostitution as, quote, victimless crime. Except I've changed my mind a fair amount about that. It's clear that every place that there's prostitution, the sex slave trade thrives. And especially state-sponsored prostitution. Why? Because the sex slave trade is not a high-end piece, right? So men who can afford it use prostitutes, right? And men who can't afford it can afford sex slaves, right? Because they're not being, the women and girls are not being paid, they charge less. And they seem to go in the same places where prostitution flourishes, so does the sex slave trade. And that being controversial, and I don't know, I honestly sort of feel torn about it. Like, well, if they did it like Nevada, maybe, I don't know. But clearly in places, if you go to Thailand, for instance, in Bangkok, where the sex trade is astounding, it's like the second biggest industry in the country in terms of income. So needless to say, the authorities are not going to shut it down, because most of the police are corrupt in the process anyway. That the sex slave trade has risen to fill a gap. Right? It's culturally acceptable for men to have mistresses and prostitutes, right? Or actually, the wives prefer the prostitutes because they'd rather not have a mistress in their lives. Okay, I'm just being honest. But that was always, you were a classy kind of guy if you could afford to go out to a brothel. And this is how, after a hard day of work on Friday night, you take your buddies. One of the things is, we might go buy a round of drinks. In Thailand, you go, buy a round of girls for your buddies. It means that you've got some wealth and you've got some prestige. Well, but there was a lower economic group who couldn't afford to do any of that. Sex slave trade came in with that gap. I don't know. You have to think about, again, that's where the confusing part of morality and ethics and law all get intertwined. Think about how we now think. Look at, you've all seen on TV all the advertisements about Las Vegas. Las Vegas could never compare to New Orleans. But New Orleans didn't have to advertise itself. Everybody knew, but Las Vegas, right, advertising is, come, do anything you want. Any perversion that you want, we'll find for you here in Las Vegas, and we'll come up with an alibi for you. You've seen the advertising. Vegas, that's what it says. If you go to the website, that's basically, this is a don't ask, don't tell. This is, anything you do here stays here kind of thing, right? Does that engender? Well, what we're discovering in Las Vegas and Nevada and all that where there is legalized prostitution is that sex slave trade is starting to appear. Because a trucker, to be honest, can't afford a bunny ranch. That's an expensive place to go. You have to have a company of plastic card, with you. You could go to the bunny ranch to enjoy it, to have a fun evening. But if you're a trucker, you can't afford that, so where are you going to go? Questions? Anyone? Yeah.
Well, I was talking about there being model legislation that you've worked on. What is that legislation address?
Why don't you just send me an email and I'll send it to you. There is state model legislation that DOJ, if you go to their website, it's on. And there's a model legislation, but I can tell you that it usually starts off as necessary because of the way the legislative houses work, is that you set up a task force first. Because you've got to prove to lawmakers that this is a necessity before they're going to add additional civil or criminal penalties to it. So if you send me an email, I'll send you the model legislation from Colorado, which mirrors the other three states as well. Once that's accomplished and once the task force has been done, then you have a better time convincing the legislators in your state to adopt a federal model for the state. The state one is the model state legislation is available at the DOJ website. You can look down, and I'll have it send you the Colorado Interagency Task Force, because that's created by bill, by law, task force, which says interagency, which means that all the law enforcement agencies are involved, and all the victims' services agencies are involved. And then people like, NGOs, if you wish, people like me get involved, so that you've studied the problem for a couple of years. and that way that you can actually say, yes, this is what we need to do. I'm already having arguments because nobody wants to do criminal statutes at all. Because that costs money. Understanding that we're always, you have to remember when you do all these things, it all costs money. And there's a limited time. And to try to find funding, you always have to try to find funding. Because when I work on task force here, the reason task force works is because Congress paid for it. So you could pull agents from DEA and from FBI and other places, and they were paid for, assistant U.S. attorneys, and they were paid for under a different fund so that you could hire other people, right, to do that. So it's a complicated political, even though it seems like a slam dunk kind of thing, who would be opposed to trying to prohibit slavery? Well, the legislators have to look at the bottom line. Each agency goes, you know, if I take one cop off the vice squad to work on this, then I've got one less cop working on vice. So do you have money for me to replace them? Are you really going to make me bust people and turn them through the criminal system? Because that people have done cost benefit analysis and all that. You want to prosecute somebody? This is how much it costs. Right? We did that at the U.S. Attorney's Office all the time. How much is it worth prosecuting? Do we have the funds to go to the U.S. government? But we have to pay attention saying, you know, if what we're going to get back is, you know, an old 57 Buick, you know, in terms of seizing it, it ain't worth going after this person. It's going to cost us $20,000 to prosecute, and we're going to get, you know, $200 out of it. Then you have to say, well, but it sets it, you know, there's other costs involved. I mean, there's other analysis that goes involved, but don't be, you know, we all know in both in private practice and in government as well, that you make choices about how much time and energy you put into a case based on how much the client has. The government is a client. It's its own client. But it has budgets. Not unlimited.
I think it's twofold. I'm curious to know, it sounds like from the number of problems that are in Washington, D.C., that this is prolific, particularly probably in areas where it would be easier to smuggle people, coastal.
Yes.
I'm not sure if that's true or not. But what is, specifically, what are the numbers of men and boys that are involved in sex trade? I mean, you talk a lot about women and girls. And
yeah. There's not so many men, obviously, but there's a growing number of boys. The boys tend to be domestic. In other words, they're not being brought in as much.
And is there a sort of allegiance between those organizations that are trafficking women and girls for men and those that are trafficking children?
Boys are pedophiles?
Yeah.
Not that I'm aware of. Although organized crime is now finding this to be a new product for them. So they don't discriminate. They don't care. Right? Product is a product. They can make money. So you have... You know, what's more disturbing, actually, with all of this is the movement is that you have now cooperative interests between the Italian mafia and Nigerian organized crime and the Russian mob and the Yakuza and these big organizations who are now in a cooperative venture, if you wish, to move and traffic people. And so if they find a niche, they don't have any sort of scruple saying, oh, well, we'll deal with women and girls, but we're not going to deal with boys. No, they'll. But from what I understand, the issue, because that's another subsector, right, dealing with pedophiles and boys, that is even more underground, if you wish, and tends to be, either men go abroad for that, right, U.S. men go abroad for that, or they use runaways and homeless boys, who are kept in homes, basically, sort of like the residential brothels. So understand, if there are 34 Latino residential brothels, you can imagine this is just one subculture, right? No. There are the Korean ones, and the Japanese ones, and the Chinese ones, and the Russian ones, and the Ukrainian ones, where the Ukrainians work together. But you can imagine what we're talking about here. We're talking about hundreds of residential brothels in this area. Hundreds. And it's... The other problem is that what we're dealing with is... Somebody asked me, well, why don't we talk to John and try to do something about the husbands? I'm like, let's be serious here. What we're talking about is either a mindset that says, these are men, for the most part, right? We're lawyers, and doctors, and judges, and ministers, good family men, right? Married, have kids, and use brothels on the side, either prostitutes or the brothels. There is not a big line. That's where we get back to the prostitution issue. Between men who use prostitutes, who then walk into a place and see
14-year-old girls who are obviously not happy with being there. There's something happens in the back here. There's a switch back here that guys have, right? That can be pushed, or that basically compartmentalizes that they could engage in this. And at a certain point, it doesn't matter if you're talking about a 25-year-old woman who is a prostitute and supposedly voluntarily doing this, or a 12-year-old girl, right? Because since they're already compartmentalized, there's not something they go home and tell their wives about, right? They don't say, you know what, they don't tell little Johnny that he's gone off to play soccer. They say, well, I'll see you at the soccer game, but I'm going to the brothel and I'll see you afterwards. Now, some of you can be aware of that, not here, okay?
But are you seeing there's an deviance to be, you know, wanting to sort of have sexual contact with a 12-year-old and a 25-year-old woman? Isn't there? I mean, it's pedophilia, it's a disease, it's not like...
Well, but, you know, all right, so 12, 14, at what point are you saying, you know, in, you know, it's not like 18, 8, 16, 18, you know, how many times have we seen in glamour magazines 12, 14-year-old girls who look like they're in their 20s, right? Because that's what we do to girls, right? So, yes, when you get to a certain point, you're moving into the pedophile, but there's this gray area, which actually starts around 14. So 14-year-old girls seem to be an acceptable target for men who would not consider, or we wouldn't consider them necessarily to be pedophiles, not in a sex slave trade, right? And that's different from being a sex offender. I mean, because pedophiles are different from men who want to have sex. That's a different disease, right, as you said. So it's a different mindset. And around 14 is where we see men basically saying, well, 14 and older, which is not an uncommon age, right, in a lot of other cultures, so we shouldn't be terribly surprised. Men do not walk into brothels and ask the girls for their license. Just see how old they are. So, any other questions? Yeah.
How do child soldiers
fit into? Oh, well, I didn't raise the issue of child soldiers. I worked with child soldiers. One of my colleagues works very intensely with child soldiers. I think child soldiers suffer from all, first of all, are slaves while they're being child soldiers. It doesn't matter to me that they carry arms, right? That there's a psychological and physical restraint and violence that has been done to them. So during the time period that they are child soldiers, both girls and boys, then I think that they fit under the whole process of, they certainly do psychologically fit into all the markers of slavery. So we're using some of the same psychological and treatment techniques for child soldiers. That's how we learned how to deal with other forms of slavery, because that was one of the key objects. You know, dealing with reintegrating the child soldiers back into the community. Same kind of trauma takes place with anyone, almost it doesn't matter what the age is, who's been enslaved. You only become enslaved when you've been so terrorized that you can't get yourself out of the situation, which means that that's a psychological part of it, right? That has changed inside your head. And it's a particularly egregious one that's really hard to deal with. Think of all the issues that come up. Whether you're killing somebody or forced to engage in sex 30 times a day, is not, psychologically, I have to tell you, there's not much of a difference there. And so you're traumatized for life at that. Or you're kept in somebody's house, even if it might be a nice house, you're kept for 3, 4, 5 years, which is, you know, 2 to 5 years is how domestic slavery usually works. And you're working 18 hours a day, beaten, and then you're traumatized for life. Even if you're in a nice high-end Washington, D.C. suburban house, right? Being enslaved, I mean, that's why I think about it. As prosecutors, I mean, as a prosecutor, I took it very seriously. If I was going to put somebody in prison for even one day, right, I better cross my T's and dot my I's. That is such fundamental freedom to take away from someone, to put them in jail for just one day. Right? But even a prisoner has a sense of saying, ah, well, after X number of years, once you're a lifer, right, then I'm going to get out and, you know, have a certain kind of freedom. Prisoners have more freedom in our prison system than domestic slaves do in Washington. that's a political piece I don't like. It's a particular stance that this administration is taking. I don't like forcing the United States. Here's the thing, say, well, if we're going to give you money, you get to conform to our standards. I always find that to be somewhat because we're often very two-faced. So if you have the TIP office, TIP office dealing with slavery around the world, and then, you know, next door is almost the same office as where you've got, we're setting up trade and agricultural agreements that actually exacerbate the slavery problem really well. Right? So the U.S. Trade Representative is setting up agricultural agreements with countries that are forcing people to starve while they're producing food for our pigs, and then forcing the growers to practice labor. So, you know, we're not consistent about that problem. And I don't know what the purpose of that is, because so you make the promise. So, do you enforce any of this stuff? So we have this thing that this report that says if you're in Tier 3, you have every repercussion to getting into Tier 3. That's also true of rights and international religious freedom, and we never enforce any of it, not at least this administration. This administration wasn't much better. Right? So you have all these countries who have failed human rights, have failed international religious freedom, have failed in terms of trafficking and slavery. But we don't do anything anyway. Now, the president always has the ability to override the suggestions of the request. Departments of State Department, DOSF, who says, I'm sure they'll do better next year. That's what this is. And it's frustrating having worked on reports on international religious freedom and on this, you know, they get slapped in the wrist. Those countries don't like it because it doesn't look good. The PR, right, to be named a Tier 3 country. Right? You want to be a Tier 3 country. But the reality is the United States is not going to bring sanctions. They're supposed to, by law. Except the president's work because he develops also on policy of the right to override what Congress would want to do. Congress creates these acts that forces us to do these yearly annual reports. And the president can ignore it as the executive can ignore it. It's prerogative of our policy. And he does. So, the Tier 3 list was 15 and was whittled down to 5 by the president. And then the remaining 5, clear. We all knew who they were anyway. No reason to do anything about it.
Questions?
Thank you all for your patience staying so late. And feel free to contact me if you have any questions. Thank you all.
I know that cheered everybody up. It's today's talk. Yes.
I'm going to the Sturm College Law.
You are?
Right now. And so I was wondering if there's anything in Denver that you're doing that I can
do. Oh, yes, absolutely. Call me, email me right away. We've got actually a whole big working group at Sturm.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, and I'll get you on that working group. Yes, right here. 2 working groups. Because I have lots of projects for Sturm people to do.
Okay, good.
And,
so you
and
have
we're
people from the Sturm College that are
yeah,
with you right now?
Yeah, we do. Okay. And we have 2 working groups, actually. And
perfect.
And so I'm actually going to have a meeting in the next couple of weeks of all the Sturm folks and start sort of doling out assignments. Because these are real practical things that the interagency task force needs right up front, the governor wants, and stuff that I want to get published. So I'm in the publishing machine business on this too. Because there's so little information out there.
Right.
And we're trying to create a body of knowledge. You know, Kevin's book is great, but it's anecdotal and not a lot of research and analysis. And so I want the different sectors, law, to do a research and analysis. You know, I need to find out to go back and look at, so what are the statutes that are in the book? Not just the federal ones, but the state ones. How they've been used. You know, we get creative about old statutes.
Right.
And it's a lot easier, as I discovered in Washington, is better to dredge out an old statute. It's much easier and revitalize it and rework it and get everybody to understand it has a new meaning. It's a lot easier to do that than to create a new law. For instance, one of the things I used was we discovered a very old bordello law for Washington that hadn't been used in, you know, over 100 years, literally had not been used in over 100 years. And we sort of dusted it off and said, this is what we're going to use now, and we're going to sort of redefine this how we're going to use it. That was a lot. And so this is the kind of thing, and also on the international area. So we've got, I only listed like 3 protocols. There's about a dozen protocols. And so are they being used? Are they gathering dust? Is anybody paying attention to them? I mean, we have protocols back to the 20s dealing with prohibition of slavery and international protocols. Does anybody pay attention? So, you know, it's certainly true that, strangely enough, there are very few state laws that deal with slavery, because it's always thought, you know, it's been a federal issue, it's a federal thing, and it was resolved after the Civil War, so nobody paid attention to it. And it was on the rare side when they would use the 1584 and 1581, they would use that as not for really for slavery. They would use it for usually in combination with kidnapping. So you would have a kidnapping, and then you would add on to it because you're holding them, right?
You
would use that to add another charge, right? And add more years of sentence. So that's what was basically dusted off fairly recently to be reused for exactly what it was meant for. Who paid attention to the 13th Amendment anymore?
Right.
I mean, we didn't need to do that anymore.
People think it's over.
It's not part of the
And that getting across that hurdle, getting across just convincing people that we have a serious slave problem in the United States. People just
don't even realize it,
or basically, some just refuse to accept it. Absolutely, yeah. And that's interesting. I mean, sort of, you know, I can crank out the number. I can show them, you know, the evidence, and they just say, nah, it's not a problem. You know, it's obviously my liberal bias that sees this thing. So then it devolves a little bit to politics, but it's one of those things, luckily at this point, this is not the kind of thing that partisan politics, it's so nasty that it's really hard to become a Republican or Democrat on this issue. In fact, I have to tell you that in Congress, if the Republicans have really taken more of the lead on legislation than the Democrats. It doesn't matter why. I mean, I've got a film.
It's not a party issue.
It's not a party issue. I mean, there's a good film that the producer stuck on an interview with Hillary Clinton. Now, I like Hillary Clinton, but she's such a catalyst. You know, she's either a lover or a hater. That when I show it, I actually don't show the last 10, 15 minutes. Because, quite frankly, if there are Republicans in the crowd, they basically discount everything they just heard because she's at the end.
Right.
And quite frankly, she's taken no leadership position in this whatsoever. So I never figured out why the producer thought it was cool to have Hillary Clinton stuck with
her.
Much like her, you know. But I think it's actually, and what I found out, you know, I'll be honest, I'm a Democrat, but I thought, if the Republicans, you should have the Republicans being interviewed, because they're the ones who've actually taken the leadership in the House and Senate. And I don't care who does it at this point.
Right.
You know, politics makes strange bedrolls.
Well,
so.
I'll send you an email right when I get back to
Denver. Yeah, do that. That'd be great.
Sean?
Sean
Mead.
Okay.
So, and I'll
great.
On your,
and you'll be happy to know the weather is just like this back in Denver.
Is it?
Or worse.
I
colder.
It'd be sunny,
no, it's I just talked to my wife. It's rainy and cold and dreary.
Well, it's good to hear that I'm not having
yeah, I'm stuck.
Thank you.
Yeah. I showed this. This was a 10-minute version of a longer piece. That you can get a free. There's several things to free the slaves that you can get now. This is called Modern Slavery. It's a 10-minute version of something called Slavery: A Global Investigation, which got a Peabody Award, a few years ago. They have a couple new ones out now too. So there's about 6 or 7 decent documentaries. There's one about called Given's Story about slavery in the United States. This is basically bringing a group of boys from Africa as gospel singers, and they were enslaved by the church and put on tour. That was a good one. There's a new one that I haven't seen out that deals with nothing but about slavery in the United States. So there's a growing number. In fact, there's Portugal just. Basically, they got the Portuguese Academy Award, which is all about trafficking. There's a film on trafficking, so it's in Portuguese, not Spanish, but it's I've got it in here someplace. So it's becoming there's more awareness of go to Free the Slaves and go to their shop, you know, and you can pick up the 10-minute or the 80-minute, and then this other one that deals with the rock quarries of northern India, and then another one that is, I don't know if they put it on the website yet, that has just come out, Slavery in the United States. They're doing a bunch of shorter pieces, you know, 20 to 50-minute documentaries in different parts of the world. And sort of a revolt took place in the quarries of northern India. And which I was glad to hear. I actually had a friend, which was heartbreaking for me, who actually bought one of these rock quarries and was using it because it was a good investment. And it took me years to, I don't know if I succeeded, but I had arguments with him all the time saying, these are not conditions you can keep people in. You know, they were bonded slaves, basically. Multi-generational bonded slaves. But it was a perfect example of somebody that I thought was reasonable, thought, well, this is a good investment, right? You get all these people crushing rock, these families crushing rock for, you know, literally pennies a day, or a few rupees a day. And he thought it was a great thing that it just passed off from generation to generation. He always had a labor force. And I said, you have a labor force because they're enforced labor. You know? And I actually, I should have done this, actually. I threatened to go buy them all out. Now, again, just like the thing with chocolate, most organizations actually stop doing that because it doesn't really resolve the problem.
Why not?
Why? Because they get right back into it. Yeah, what you have to do is you have to do that in combination with microeconomics. And you don't give any of the money to the men because they just drink it or smoke it away, to be honest. So you set, if you buy people out of slavery, you have to engage microeconomics with the women of the family so that they become self-sufficient. Otherwise, you buy them out of the rock quarry, and then where are they going to go? Right? 3 generations, 4 generations, 5 generations of rock quarry workers, these are not exactly skilled laborers. And so they get hungry. They have medical expense. And that's what happens to them all the time. You know, they get enough money sometimes, actually paid some enough rupees to have rice and lentils, rice and dal, to feed themselves, barely. They get basically one meal a day, maybe two if they're lucky. But the problem is so that they have subsistence. Now what I did, I should have started, I woke up in the middle of the night, and the statistics I should have started with is that 24,000 people die each day from malnutrition. Each day in the world. And that's directly equated to this process of slavery, right? Because, you know, listen, if the question is between starving to death and your children starving to death and working for somebody for nothing but having just enough rice and lentils to keep yourself and your family alive, you do that. Mm-hmm. So the problem then runs into other things. They get sick, so they need some medical. So it's the owner of the rock quarry pays for that, but then adds that to the bill. So you can never, if you stay perfectly, can you imagine staying perfectly healthy, working in a rock quarry 16 hours a day for your entire life? Well, no, you're going to get sick. And that's where the owner gets you, right? So the quarry worker owner says, claims innocence, I pay my people, they can live on this. But then you look at the ledger, and the ledger shows that, in fact, they're in debt. Now, it's not a huge debt again. You can get most of them out for clearly under $100. That would be exorbitant amount of money that somebody owed. But, so you get them out, they go work again someplace, now they're debt-free, they go work for another place, and as soon as somebody gets sick, they're back into debt. You start off, you know, and I've seen multi-generation literally for less than $5. That's been the debt for 2 generations. $5. 3 generations. So you have to combine it with then giving them something else to do. And that's not so easy, especially if they don't belong, if they are sort of itinerant quarry workers, because they may not actually belong to a village and have a family structure. So this is a subset of the society who've been doing this for a long time. So that to reset them so they have some sense, in fact, internal sense that they can do this. And that's that, so you give her enough money to buy a sewing machine, but then you're going to have to show her how to sew because she's never sewn before. And who has time to sew if you're breaking rock all day? So those kinds of things. So can it be done? Yeah. But it's a cooperative venture that is really hard to do. Millennium Project of the United Nations is actually working towards that end. But, you know, now we have John Bolton help us in there basically trying to undercut the promises we've already made to the Millennium Project, which is trying to reduce poverty and, you know, cut in half the poverty level. We're talking about different, you know, there's no absolute poverty left in the United States. We have relative poverty, a fair amount of that. But there's absolute poverty means you don't have enough don't get enough calories to survive. That's why we lose. I mean, it's hard to imagine. Somebody dies every 2.3 seconds. In the time we have been here, 1,500 people have died because they don't have enough food. Is there enough food in the world? We do know that there's enough food, but we don't have the distribution network. We don't have the willingness of governments and NGOs and corporations to distribute properly. We've got, quite frankly, trade agreements that exacerbate the problem. No one on the planet, I mean, we've crunched the numbers. There's no reason for anyone to die of starvation. You can die of lots of other things. So, I mean, it's what Kevin gets to in the film, I think, is true. It's a willingness to do this. It's not that we already have everything we need. I'm convinced, yeah, all right, state by state, it'd be nice to have some more laws, be helpful for state officials. But actually, on the federal level, internationally, we have certainly all the laws we need. We have everything we need to eradicate trafficking, or a chunk of trafficking. The problem is that it's a complex, it's not just trafficking because of economics, it's trafficking because of warfare and civil unrest and all sorts of other kinds of things. So it would take a kind of, you know, the depth of the commitment is the tough one, because you can't just say stopping trafficking. Well, you can do that by raising, you know, 40-foot walls around the United States, I suppose. We can become a big gated community, which we're trying to do anyway. Right? But it really takes rethinking an economic structure that I don't think we have. It's like the war on drugs when I was used to do that. None of us, I mean, we didn't say this to the public, really thought the war on drugs was silly. You know, whether it was prosecutors or the FBI or DEA, in the sense that saying, we really don't want to spend the time, money, and energy to really deal with this problem because it's not their problem, it's our problem. And it's easier to keep it in the ghettos, you know. Keep it in Southeast. That's okay. But let's not talk about the fact that most of the drugs are actually in the burbs. And it's the white kids coming in, you know, to buy their drugs, and then it costs you at other places, right? We won't, because those parents don't want to hear about that stuff, you know, and we won't prosecute them. Better to keep it, you know. So I got convinced that we have a certain level of manageable violence that we're willing to deal with, to put up with, rather than actually resolve the problem. I think it's also going to be true with slavery. And I don't, you know, so, I mean, look at how we deal with labor. I think, and I just saw the new programs that Cheritoff is coming up with. Basically, we want to have our own, we already do, right? Europe doesn't want Turkey in the EU. Why? Because if Turks become part of the EU, they have to be paid EU wages. Who wants to pay? That's the whole point of having Turkey on the outside. That's the whole point of having Mexico to our southern border, right? You really don't want to have our own version. You don't want to have a NAFTA that looks like an EU. Why? Because we want this subclass. As long as we decide we want a subclass of a working force, a subclass is like prostitution, well then, like engender a slave class. That's clear. So, it's, you know, so, okay, so I don't have to pay somebody $5.20 an hour to be a day laborer. I can pay them $2.50 an hour. How about if I just feed them lunch, breakfast and lunch? After all, at least they're getting fed. Right? It's easy to slip there. It happens in Denver. Happens here. I've met men who basically get fed for their work. So what's that? It's better than starving to death. It's better for them than the kitchens and other places. So it's a choice that we force people to have to make. That's the hard part. We can remember that we're forcing people to make those choices that they shouldn't have to make. Right? So you can get into a weird ethical argument when you say, well, that at least they're alive. Yeah. Okay. I suppose, you know, being alive is better than dead, for most people, at least. But the fact that we force them to have to make that choice, That's the moral problem, not because we're somehow generous by feeding them. Yeah, I mean, I hear on the domestic slave cases all the time, well, you know, at least she's in the United States, as though that's, because otherwise she'd be back in her poor village back, you know, in South America someplace or Central America someplace, right? As though that's an excuse. I mean, that's a bizarre rationale. When you get to that kind of rationale, and I've talked to
folks who hold the domestic slaves. That's the argument I get all the time. She's better off being in the United States in our house in this situation than being back home in her village. Really? Now, that even may be technically true. Technically true. Right? She has more calorie intake. The fact that somebody can get there with their argument. Anybody who makes that kind of argument is, to me, is morally corrupt. Right, that's right. Right.
Our freedom
is. Yeah. So, yeah. When we get into the, when treating people like products, you know, this is what happens. So.
What do you suggest for? I have a friend who started an organization specifically for India,
uh-huh,
for sex trafficking.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like trying to help them grow it.
Uh-huh.
It's very new, like 2 years old.
Uh-huh.
Do you suggest they?
There are lots of there are already a number of very good organizations doing work. You never can tell whether a plethora of NGOs does more good. I think that I have no problem with increasing number of NGOs on any particular area that needs to be worked, as long as there's that you start forming networks. And to be honest, NGOs tend to compete with each other all the time. It's actually pretty nasty, and I don't have a lot of patience for that. I understand the politics, and I can play it too. But on this issue, for instance, since we're all new at this, I've been trying to engender a sense of cooperation. So, if this person, basically, if there's a place that this person wants to work in India, it tends to be more helpful to be geographically specific.
Yeah, it's like his village.
Oh, okay. Well, then that would be great, because then he can tie in and get resources from other organizations in India who are doing the same work.
Mm-hmm.
And even if he doesn't get financial necessary resources, there's all sorts of other kinds of resources that he can get, and then tied into a larger network.
Mm-hmm.
So that, it might not... that alone is really an important issue, to find out what the resources are. So that, okay, so... I've got a problem here, so who do I get to take care of the issue dealing with somebody burning his wife in the kitchen? Or that's one organization that deals with that. There's another organization that can deal with the microeconomics issue. There's another organization that can deal with the children and educating the children. And so then he can get tied into those other groups, so he doesn't have to do it all himself. He can say, okay, I'm in charge of my village, and then find people to bring in to handle other aspects of it. So, or at the very least, they'll give. There's a lot of organizations who give them startup money, and then help them monitor the process. Microeconomics is a great way to do it, but it has to. You have to work at it, and the person managing the money has to work at it and be honest, be firm about it. Not everybody succeeds at microeconomics. People do fail at it. You have to be a good banker and manager and a social worker and taskmaster all at the same time when you do this kind of work. Contact these groups and especially both Free the Slaves and Polaris Project. Free the Slaves have a lot of contacts in India. I think Polaris Project is picking them up. They're mostly in Japan and the United States right now. But there are plenty of anti-slavery organizations in India, tons of them actually, doing very good work. A lot of faith-based initiatives, which looks differently in India than it does here. So Catholic workers, or lots of other groups that actually are providing great schools and are not evangelizing, they're just trying to get into poor neighborhoods and help people out. So, and boarding schools. Okay.
I just wondered, some of these organizations aren't up there. Are any of them more specific to children?
One that's not up there is Free a Child.
Okay.
Look them up. It's like freeachild.org, I think.
Okay.
So it's easy to find. And they're Boulder-based.
Mm-hmm.
And again, they started off in Thailand because everybody thought it was an external problem. Right? Probably other countries, not here. So they do United States and Thailand, basically. But they're expanding and trying to get people to work in other countries as well. There's lots of children's organizations in different countries as well. So if you contact Free a Child, you're interested in working with children, and there's a country that they don't work with, they'll find the right organization to put you in contact with, whether it be Ukraine or Russia or someplace or almost any area of the world.
Okay.
to be honest, the least developed area is Central South America on these issues, right? Except for coffee and charcoal. So, and even that is really tenuous. So it's not and I don't know why that's true. I don't think there's just not been a lot of focus. There's a lot of hotter spots in the world, which is where the attention is going. That's why, right? Former Soviet countries and East Asia countries. So I think that some attention needs to be put. Spotlight needs to be put in Mexico, Central and South America, clearly, and the Caribbean, because I see a lot of transit happening between going through the Caribbean and into the United States and into Europe. So there's transit coming in from those areas, clearly. But not much in terms of internal investigations. Although the tier list is really is pretty intense. Here's my tier list. Tier 3, let me see where my other page go, which is the worst, is Bolivia, Cuba, Ecuador, Jamaica, Venezuela, and then, the Tier 2 watch list is another, it's like 6 or 8, Central and South American countries. So there's clearly a problem, and there's not a lot done by the governments to acknowledge it. But since there's no sanctions, it's difficult to enforce. So the homegrown organizations have to start up in those countries, and I think that's where that's lacking at the moment. When I talk to the general counsels, they're sort of operating on their own here in the United States, without acknowledging that there are people coming from their countries to be into forced labor here. So there's not much being done by the government's home, so they're having to deal with the end problem rather than dealing with the original problem, which is economics, again, it goes back to a lot of economics. Or false promises. So it's not just that, it's not that people are smuggling themselves across illegally, some of them are coming illegally, or, there's a lot of false front organizations in the United States now bringing people in to work in clubs and stuff like that.
You said that smuggling can become really into trafficking.
Right.
What do you draw the line? I mean, if part of the past PTA sanctions, a lot of times convicting
smugglers
or trafficking.
A trafficker can be also convicted as a smuggler. Mm-hmm. Right. Using the combination of TVPA and immigration and U.S. Suit 1324. So that you can combine lots of these issues in. So, most often what happens is that with the victim can often start as a smuggling. So you clearly have the intent. You decide that you want to come to the United States, for instance, and you pay your $2,000 and you're free and clear. And it doesn't really matter how you got to the United States. You can switch into trafficking once you're here. And so that's why it's important to deal with borders, because you can come here and get here legally and work sort of illegally, if you wish, and for cash, but not be enslaved, and then get yourself into a situation that you then become enslaved, in which case you've just moved from being an illegal alien to somebody who is being trafficked in the United States. And it can happen with an easy switch. So you're washing dishes in a restaurant in New York, right? And all of a sudden the employer says, I'm not paying you anymore, and if you raise a fuss, I'm going to turn you in. That person has just gone from being an illegal alien who smuggled himself or was smuggled in the United States to be somebody who was involved in trafficking, and trafficked, right? Being taken advantage of his vulnerable situation. So.
Because I was talking to, I don't know if you know,
Mizubaka,
who works with the
DOJ
here.
Oh, yes, I do. Yes, I did.
About a lot of these conflicts.
Uh-huh.
He told me that they grapple with the issue of they're bringing women in from Ukraine or even from Mexico, and they're with the intent of trafficking them back to place a concubine.
Right.
But if they escape, they're actually going to end up being a victim.
The trafficker?
Right.
Or I see, okay.
So he said that
Oh, the attempt to. In other words, if they get here, they're attempt.
Because you said the statute is not clear on that.
It's not clear. I mean, I would take an aggressive stance on that. But then, you know, then it gets even more confusing because we have this thing called T visas, which you might be aware
right.
of. And we have like an allocation of like 5,000 of them. And what do we give out? 74 last year or something like that? So obviously we're not even using those effectively, I think. Well, the T visas have been around for a long time. The additional use of how you use T visas, but trying to convince somebody, first of all, T visas are still temporary. So it's not exactly a great incentive. So traditionally, and I think the model still sits in their heads, is that it will give you a visa as long as you're cooperating with the prosecution. And then when we're done with the case, by the way, you get to go home. So why would you cooperate if that's true? Now that's starting to change so that we're starting to give green cards out for full cooperation. But what constitutes full cooperation? Because not everybody who gets a T visa gets to be a resident. What if they stop cooperating? Well, they're only good as long as they're cooperating and as long as the case is good. So it's the prosecutor who can very much determine whether or not that person is going to wind up with a green card or not for their efforts. So I think we need to make a lot more effort in trying to... of course, I have a particular stance. If somebody's been victimized in the United States, I think that we ought to give them a green card and not mess around with. You know, if we can get them to cooperate on a prosecution, great, but that should not be a requirement, I don't think. If you've got a prima facie case that you've been trafficked and therefore you're a victim, then we as a society owe you this kind of thing. Now, the fear of government is that, well, everybody will take advantage of it. It's like, well, you get yourself in the United States and, you know, get pregnant and have a child born in the United States if you're going to have a U.S. citizen child. You know, that's not done as much as people think it is. You know, folks don't, you know, yes, you can calculate to some degree, but the other part is that DOJ has sort of philosophical restriction. There's the opposing force that comes out of Homeland Security and immigration. Immigration has always had in their minds that their primary job is to keep people outside the United States, right? That's their purpose in life. Add on to the fact that it is now subsumed under Homeland Security, and Homeland Security treats everyone as a potential, I'm serious, as a potential terrorist. So you've got a conflict within government, which is one whole part of government which now has more sway, really would like to these people kept in detention centers and shipped back home as soon as possible. And a smaller voice saying, but they're victims. We ought to help them out. And so what happens, I think, is that because there's a certain timidity on the part of DOJ on this issue. So we're not going to be aggressive in our prosecution of these gray areas. We're just going to deal with the ones that are clear-cut as far as we're concerned. So ambiguity in the statute means that it's really hard to prosecute traffickers to begin with.
Yeah.
It's astoundingly difficult.
The proof?
Well, you know, first of all, to get people to do this work, to testify against a trafficker, when you've been told face-to-face, you're dead if you testify against me.
Right.
And if you're not dead, your family's also dead. You know, it's a little bit... I saw that starting to happen in drugs with the Russian mob because they didn't play by the rules of the game. Traffickers do not, none of them from any of the organized crime groups play by normal standards of how the game is played. This is a game that we play. You know, the good guys and the bad guys and the sort of the system holds together because everybody plays by the rules. Even the lawbreakers say, oh, I've been caught. This, you know, that's the way the game is played. But now you have people who say, well, the hell with you. I mean, most of my colleagues are surprised I don't have a full-time bodyguard. My Eastern European, my Asian colleagues. And they do, who are doing the same work I'm doing. And when I start traveling abroad, one of the things I have to build into my cost is I have to have a full-time bodyguard. I never had to do that when I was dealing with drugs. Right? It's like, in fact, the drug dealers was like, hands off, you know, this guy's a prosecutor or whatever. We're not going to play. We don't play that kind of game. No. Traffickers think I'm a problem. They'll just kill me. Right. Well, fortunately, I don't have to worry about that. States yet. Yes.
Yes. And this report, the Trafficking Persons Report,
uh-huh.
Is there any way that I can, like,
online?
Yeah, yeah, you just go to the TIP office.
Okay.
Yeah, this is from the TIP office, and then the DOJ has their own one. It is called, well, I can show you what it looks like. They've got the acts in there, and then the assessment of U.S. government activities, combat trafficking in persons. There are actually two of them. So you've got the TIP report that comes out once a year, and that's Department of State, and then these two reports from Justice. The assessment, that's one of the U.S. government, and then the other one is a report to Congress from Gonzalez,
okay.
the Attorney General. That one is much thicker and has lots of documentation and other kinds of things. So those are the three major U.S. documents that we deal with. The U.N. is not doing enough either. But that's partially because the way it was, the office was set up, the funding is voluntary. And so the U.N. office that deals with this topic has a budget of maybe $20,000 a year. $20,000 a year to deal with this problem. That's good. And the United States doesn't want to give any money to it, clearly, because it's the UN, after all. I think it has to be, at this point, I think it needs to be subsumed under UNHCR or somebody like that. It's taken seriously, but it's kind of broken up into different groups. So folks who deal with humanitarian law deal with it they see it when it's happening with conflicts. So when children's soldiers arise, or when we're in war-torn areas and all of a sudden you discover that women and girls are being trafficked, and the troops, U.S. troops and, Pakistani troops or whatever, are engaging in the sex slave trade on the ground in places of conflict. So we discovered that after Bosnia and all that, is that there was a fair that the NATO troops and other troops were taking advantage. So the sex slave, that was the internal trafficking, right? So, in a sense. So all of a sudden the sex slave trade grows enormously in places of conflict. But I don't see enough of a real worldwide effort. I mean, Kevin gives testimony to or works with the UN. I don't. Kevin Bales. Kevin Bales is the author of this book. He's the head of Free the Slaves also. He just has a second book out, so. Something like Slavery, a Reader, or something like that. Yeah. So it just came out. I just got a notice of the same press. So if you look under Kevin Bales, the new book will be. It's not even on his website, which is bizarre. So I don't know. It's really new.
Well, I just wanted to let you know that I applied to the EU, and one of the reasons they did so was because I was very interested in your
project. Oh.
So.
Wow. It's interesting that it's getting out. I mean, it's the, I've had to sort of create this thing. And right now I've got, I've expanded the task force. So now it includes all those other groups I was talking about. And I'm finding, the task force has over 100 people in it now, mostly graduate students. But I'm also developing relationships. So there's a faculty member and sort of a senior graduate student from each one of these different disciplines. So I'm trying to get other coursework so that, you might not be able to get a minor or, get a certificate. But if you were to come to DU within the next couple of years, I think I'll be able to say, you have my 10-week course, which I just got approved by the dean to start next year, which is an overview. And then you can go to International Disaster Psychology, take a full-year course that deals with many of these issues that apply then to folks who are victims. You can go to social work. I mean, trying to find different places that you could say you sort of put together your own training program. And I have internships programs that I'm setting up around the world, too. I've got a book that thick now of organizations that are starting to set up contracts with and send graduate students off to do this work.
I was
going to
ask, I'm a first year, so I'm beginning to look for internships. How do you get your foot in the door? What's the best place to start?
Well, I know that both, I can tell you that both Free the Slaves and Polaris look for interns, and they're here in Washington. That makes it nice, I suppose. What I found out about, it's always the question whether you want to get paid or not, right?
Are you being idealistic or are you being realistic?
I'm being realistic. Well, because there's a lot of organizations that are happy to take interns that, as long as you don't have to they don't have to pay you, which I jokingly give them a hard time saying, well, that means you're engaging in slave labor, isn't it? then they come back, and they have a retort saying, don't you treat all your graduate students like slave labor? Is there an area of the world that you want to work in, or just...
I speak Spanish fluently. I have a very introductory level of Chinese, because I know that very, very
big. Right. Well, I would start by contacting the folks. Polaris' Mote Degen does mostly domestic, but what they're doing, when I say domestic, I really mean in-country. So they start off here in the United States, but they're trying to expand so that their office in Tokyo deals with the issue in Japan. Japanese are not very amenable to the idea. They refuse to believe it exists. Since they have this sensibility about foreigners, especially foreign women in their country, so it's like, you know, you shouldn't be here anyway, so why should we bother taking any kind of energy to protect you, kind of thing. So they're trying to set up offices slowly around the world. What is nice about Polaris, from what I understand, is that they actually have a pretty decent training program too. So that you become a fellow, in which case that means when you're designated as fellow, they've been through their training program of some kind. So you both want to do an internship and get some nice little piece of credentials to go with it, which doesn't hurt. I have found out, that's why I started working to set up internships and a real program, is that NGOs that aren't normally, don't have budgets right now because lots of reasons to hire anybody, I've been told sort of on the side, but if you have somebody who's really knowledgeable about trafficking, we have a place for them in our organization. So, because NGOs and IOs are discovering, especially worldwide NGOs are discovering how much of a problem, and a lot of organizations that hadn't had to deal with it before are having to deal with it now. And a lot of the bigger faith-based groups, World Vision and lots of other organizations, are doing really good work with that. Some are really kind of controversial. There was one I was just dealing with, I'm spacing out their name. They conduct raids on their own. For instance, they wear, you know, bug, they wear cameras and stuff and do raids without local authorities to help them out sometimes. And they run into a problem, which is that they, few of them do this, but this organization, there's a little bit of evangelizing in the process. So they could do good work, but then they have this other piece that makes them controversial. Not the least of which is that they encounter every now and then, you can do a raid on a brothel, on some of the bigger brothels, and you'll discover again, like the people coming to the United States, a range of women. Those who are there clearly forced to be there as sex slaves, and others who will say, insist, that they're there on their own free will making money. And this organization basically, in a sense, refuses to believe the latter, saying, you've been so brainwashed, you can't possibly want to work here, kind of thing. So we're going to liberate you. It sort of has a feeling of, PETA, kind of thing. So we're going to liberate you whether you want to be liberated or not. So they're controversial, but they get work done when local authorities, which are so corrupt, obviously won't. So I don't know. I mean, I feel torn about how they function as an organization. Most don't operate that way. Most try to work with local government. But again, the problem is, I have to say that the problem with the places it's worse is the place where the police are corrupt. They're going to be paid a lot more by the trafficker. Angel Foundation is a Russian organization I worked with closely. Said it was really quite amazing because, they would get a girl free and then she would show up show up to the airport and they would have their sign, Angel Foundation, right, so that she would know where to go, and they would see the trafficker also holding up the sign saying Angel Foundation. And they were not sure, and then there would be a tussle, and they would not be sure how the cops were going to go, because clearly the Angel Foundation can't pay the cop anything, but the Russian mob is, happy to have her go with other person holding the sign. So, because it's a very dangerous business. I should make that clear to people. I suppose it's gotten real dangerous to do the work, or can be really dangerous. So, and this whole area of confidentiality. And I mean, Angel Foundation, for instance, goes through this huge process by which they have all this multiple layers of security in terms of girls and women calling them, so that they can't be monitored, and they're very intense about protecting their databases because they're human traffickers to have access. Traffickers aren't stupid; they know exactly what to do. So, I've never met a group of people like this. I thought I'd work with hardened folks. I remember prosecuting a guy in here who had Kevin Gray was his name. Sit across the table from him, and I knew he had ordered the murder of a dozen colleagues. He seemed far more reasonable to work with than almost any trafficker I've ever met. Right. At least for Kevin, it was like occasional, and it was business, and it was not. These were competitors, and these were not for people within his own organization that betrayed him or something like that. And it wasn't sort of. You wouldn't have thought of just sort of indiscriminately killing his clients or whatever it might be. These folks. Anyway.
Can I ask you how Argentina?
Yes, I can. You can.
Sorry.
Oh, that's all right. It'll be easier just to go to my... to your place and stuff. Makes it easy. Okay.
And who
Argentina is in tier two. Tier two means there's a problem. Problem means that we designate a problem by saying when there's clearly over 100 people who are trafficked or forced labor. And tier two means that the Argentina does not meet the minimum standards for dealing with the problem, but it hasn't fallen into tier two watch list or tier three, which means making no efforts. It means that Argentina is making efforts but not reaching. There's an individual description, and you can go to the Department of State and see if I can find Argentina for you, and you can read on your own. Here it is. So this is Argentina. This is what we do with each country that has a problem, which means that anybody over 100